passe un bon artiste. Super, encore un but sensationnel.
That's a brilliant bit of follow-up play by Mahé. Oh my goodness me, what a shot.
Sagosen. Sagosen setter det hen. Han setter den. De I semifinalen.
Hello everyone, it's the Uninformed Handball Hour. It's Chris O'Reilly here with you today and joined by Alex Kulish.
How are you, Chris?
And Brian Campion's not here at the moment. He's off working somewhere in the middle of the Austrian countryside. However, we will be joined by Trine Nielsen, 2004 Olympic gold medalist from Denmark, as she speaks to us about one of the most incredible finals of all time. Seeing as today, when we launch it, it would have been the opening of the Tokyo 2020 Olympics, which unfortunately has been pushed back 1 year. So all we can do, as we've done for much of this year, is look back and look back at wonderful, fond handball memories and try and pass the time there. But we do have some up-to-date and real handball news to talk about. And I'm really happy I've got Alex here for the IHF World Handball Player of the Year Awards. Because, well, I'm pretty sure he has something to say about them. Alex, let's start with the men's winner. And Niklas Landin gets the crown.
I saw that and I got instantly confused. Because that's what happens when I get these results of the IHF World Player of the Year. More than halfway through 2020, without finished 2020 season, we have just received the World Player between the period of January 1st, 2019 and 31st of December, 2019. So I had to kind of rail back in my head and understand what actually happened in that year. What did that player achieve? What events happened that year? You know, what happened? And that made me remember the 2018 IHF World Player of the Year, which was Mikkel Hansen. And that one I had the biggest issue with, because 2018 wasn't a fabulous year for Mikkel Hansen. If we're talking about the actual competition, the international competition that happened in 2018, we had Denmark finishing fourth in the European Handball Championship. PSG finished third in the Champions League. Mikkel Hansen was actually injured for most of that campaign, so like the tail end of the 2017-18 campaign. And he didn't play that much. He was kind of forced out of the team. He was on the bench. And then in January 2019, just emphasized January 2019, he had one of the greatest performances we have seen on an international stage of any player ever. He was incredible.
He was. And I remember, Alex, that we had a conversation on this very podcast about last year's results. And I think the conclusion was that Mikkel Hansen didn't deserve it for 2018, but he's already won it for 2019. And that's us talking about 1 year ago, so the middle of 2019.
Exactly. So to my surprise, I saw his countryman and a player that performed incredibly well in that championship as well, Niklas Landin, getting the 2019 Player of the Year award. Quite deserving. But what is it actually based off? Again, I had to go into Wikipedia, I had to check out the new history page of the European Handball website and figure out what Niklas Landin did in the club career in 2019, which was not participate in the Champions League. Kiel were not there. In the Bundesliga, they finished second behind Flensburg. And actually, Landin shared his time 50-50 with Wolf that year. His save percentage in the Bundesliga was 32%, kind of middle of the road. We all know that Landin really brings it to the fore when the pressure's on, and he had some incredible performances that year. But overall, not the huge standout year that it was really based on. And they won the EHF Cup. That's the second tier European competition. So really, the whole award comes down to the World Championship that happened in 2019 in January. And I would say Landin was probably the third best player on that Danish team. He was incredible, but Hansen and Lauge were, for me, better players. So completely confused me. And the fact that the award was awarded in July of this year, where last year it was awarded in March. So this time around, the voters didn't have that extra bit of motivation from a recent championship where they didn't vote Duvnjak, they didn't vote Sagason. None of the Spanish players got in there, which really performed in that international competition.
It was so far removed, it was good in a way.
Exactly.
But it should have been 7 months earlier before the championship. We discussed that last time. But okay, so you're saying if the World Championship is the measuring stick here, you've got three Danish players here who all won the World Championship in 2019. And you say based on that, Niklas Landin was the third best player behind two fellow nominees, Rasmus Lauge and Mikkel Hansen. Just for the sake of context, there were two more nominees, Sandra Sagerson and Lukas Sindrich. I'm guessing then your choice is between Rasmus Lauge and Mikkel Hansen.
Well, it should have been Mikkel Hansen. He should have been rewarded for his amazing campaign with the 2019 award, not the 2018 reward that he got. Which just, as always, this absolute mess that happens with the international competitions being at the start of the year that causes this whole confusion. And it was quite difficult. Like, at first glance, Landin got the award well-deserved. He has been an incredible player. But again, I'm thinking of this season where in the Champions League, Kiel in 2020 have been very good. And that skews it for me.
I mean, even with team awards and, you know, you could say that although Niklas Landin won the EHF Cup, that's kind of equal to Mikkel Hansen winning the French League, maybe, because they finished nowhere in the Champions League. But Mikkel Hansen was so good. It was out of this universe last January. It was completely unprecedented, almost. One single person's impact on a team and on a championship. Top scorer with 72 goals. And the MVP of the World Championship. And they won the title, or they cruised to the title in the end. He was amazing in that. And yes, they didn't have a great Champions League season after that. Had kind of a freak quarterfinal exit against Kielce. But yeah, they won the French League. He was, I think, the all-star team left back in the French League and the Champions League. And even without all of that, if you're talking about the IHF and the World Handball Player of the Year, World Handball Championship is the main thing, and he was the main man.
Exactly. So congratulations to Niklas Landin. He's probably on the way to becoming the 2020.
is this just what's happening now?
Sagason, where does Sagason fit in here? Because he's actually the current best player in the world. Where does this fall in?
Maybe that's what it should be. Just who is the best player in the world right now? Whenever the IHF decide to have the vote. Because it's a different time every year. Who's the best player in the world right now? Sander Sagason was. Last year was Mikkel Hansen. But yeah, it's like it's almost predicting who will be the best player of the next year, halfway through it.
And also the fact, so just to mention that the award was given in July this year. And that was actually a deliberate plan because it was planned to be given at the end of the handball week, which was just last week, which is a good idea. But, you know, it wasn't something that was impacted by COVID or something that they had to put off or etc. It was actually planned for this time this year. So actually, if the season had finished as normal, we would have had a champion of every league and a new champion of the Champions League very recently in our memory happening now, and had to vote on 2019.
And it could have been Niklas Landin and Kiel to win it. Who knows? Could have been Lukas Sindrich and Barca. But yeah, in that case, if they're going to have it in July, why not just have the player of the season? That's the safest bet. It means no matter what, you're going to take into consideration the most recent world or European championship. You're going to take into consideration the whole current season where one player is playing for one team and you're going to get the Champions Leagues and the league titles in there. But that's a big old change of tactic. I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. And on the women's side, Stine Oftedal won it for the first time. And the first time in a couple of years, I think we've had a Norwegian. Just a quick overview of the nominees there. You had Anna Vea Kareva, Estevana Polman, Stine Oftedal, Lois Abing, and Tess Fester. Very similar to the men's one, you had three players from the world champions, which is a lot easier to remember because it was just in December. So three players from the Netherlands there. Then Vea Kareva, part of two teams, Russia and Rostov Don, who are being in the final weekend of both the World Championship and the Champions League. But her individual performances kind of outperform her team performances. And then Stine Oftedal, who was the best player for Djurgården as they won the Champions League last season. Norway didn't do quite so well as they planned to. I think the semi-final loss was a bit of a shock for them. But there, the World Championship didn't count quite so much. She wasn't in the All-Star team. She was the seventh top scorer at the World Championship. But the Champions League is what drove her to victory there. So a bit of a different approach there. But I think the important thing to remember is that I believe the fan voting is the definitive factor here. Am I right?
Yes, I think so. So the experts pick the players and then the fans vote, which, again, is a ridiculous concept.
Are the two coaches of the year, the two world champions. Simple. Nikolaj Jakobsen of Denmark, Emmanuel Mayonaad of the Netherlands. And Mayonaad had a good season with Metz as well. Jakobsen, not so great with Reinier Gulluven, if I'm not mistaken.
No, not at all.
Well, no, it was the World Championship that earned him the coach's title. So, yeah, I guess difficult to argue too much with the coach's side of things. But there you go. That's the World Handball Player and Coaches of the Year for over 7 months ago sorted.
Amazing. I can't wait until the 2020 version, probably in 22 or something at this rate.
In other very recent news, we're recording on a Monday. The teams for the second and third tier of European club handball has been announced today by the EHF. New names for them. The EHF European League is now the second tier, so what the EHF Cup used to be. And the EHF European Cup is now what the Challenge Cup used to be. They both sound very similar. That could provide some difficulties, but maybe we're not going to focus so much on the old Challenge Cup. But the European League, which is the new second tier, a lot of good teams in there. Over the last few days and weeks, there's been news of some big teams deciding not to take part, though.
Yeah, Hanover dropped out, as well as Rioja from Spain. So two quite significant teams. They would have been, let's say, EHF Cup regulars. And Hannover Burgdorf, especially, quite an ambitious team. And both cited reasons for health and safety risks involved in competing in a European Championship, as well as just the financial strain that it brings on the teams. Because while the new Champions League format has received a bump of let's say prize money, revenue, kind of a bump of attention, the EHF Cup has always been, it's actually a lot of teams have mentioned that it's more of a financial burden to compete than the benefit financially that they get from competing in it. This is kind of expected from a second tier European competition. You know, we all know this from the Europa League or anything of that sort in different sports. Of course, there's the bonus of the winner of the new European League now participating in the Champions League. So that will drive a lot of the top clubs in there to really focus on the competition. I think teams like Montpellier, Reinier Gulluven, kind of the from the major leagues, the second, third teams from the major leagues could potentially be their only way into the Champions League. Hopefully it's quite a good competition.
Yeah, I can understand like the approach for some teams, as you said, that they might see it as the easier way almost to get into the Champions League the following season, or a guaranteed way. You're not, like, if you're going to finish second or third in the German League, nothing is guaranteed. You could be bumped out of it for whatever reason. But if you win this competition, it's a surefire way in. But, you know, for teams from Spain, maybe La Rioja feel that they have a better chance of making a push for second place in the Spanish league and getting in that way. The other aspect of the financial side of things is that there's no guarantee the clubs are going to get fans in for these games as well, which for a lot of nations, these games would be quite attractive. And the money you could get in for it would make it worthwhile. But if you're looking at it now saying, okay, we could have, you know, these qualification rounds and some of the group phase matches without any fans, then it's a big hit to take. And you're only losing money from travel, for example, or hosting other teams, but not getting anything back in terms of bumps on seats. Despite that, a lot of good teams in there, even like down in the first round. So the HF have seeded teams directly to the group phase. So 12 of them, there's going to be a group phase of 24 teams. So half of them are set. Got teams in there like Magdeburg, Pellister, who we heard a few weeks ago, are really building something interesting in North Macedonia. Vizla Płock, your favorite team, Alex. Dinamo Bucharesti, who narrowly missed out in the Champions League. Kadetten Schaffhausen, who are fairly regularly in there as well. Besiktas, Tatran Preshov, Alingsås, all teams that have, and Tchaikovsky Medvedi, teams that have some Champions League experience. Nîmes from France as well, and Adamar Leon, two teams that did pretty well in the second tier last season. And then in the qualification rounds, you've got teams like Toulouse, Montpellier, Fuchsia Berlin, Rhein-Neckar Löwen, Sporting, and GOG as well from Denmark. So there's some big names that still have to get through a round to qualify for the group phase. And even back in the first qualification round, SK Minsk is in there, Bjerringbro, Skjern, Holstebro, all from Denmark, Bidasoa Irun, who are in the Champions League last season. Who else you got in there? Metalurg, some old school Champions League, Benfica, CSKA, which I think is an interesting project if the women's team is anything to go by. And then Malmö and Kristianstad from Sweden as well. So lots of big teams in there at every single round. So it'll be an interesting one, particularly for the handball hipsters, you know, who want to watch something outside of the talent-laden Champions League. You're going to see some interesting games and maybe some shocks in the European Cup.
Yeah, I think.
European League.
European League. Yeah, it's actually quite confusing. I was trying to do a bit of research on the Champions League, the European League, and the HF Cup, and they all just, every time I would put in one of the names, all of the competitions showed up, because right now Google's just not used to new names. It's just a bit of a mess. But I think it's a good first step that the European League potentially could be getting a bit more focus from the HF or from the organizers to try to make it a bit more of a prestigious competition, because basically, over the last couple of years, it's been a route for German teams into the Champions League, especially the old format where the final four hosts of the EHF Cup would be guaranteed a place in the final four of the competition as long as they made it through the group. I think that devalued the competition a little bit. It's difficult to take a competition fully seriously when it has these kind of weird rules to make sure that the competition ends up in a country where fans actually show up. So hopefully with some of these kind of bigger teams landing in this new European League, we'll get some pretty good games and it gets a life of its own as opposed to this kind of sidekick that it's been for a long time.
There's a lot of teams in there who you could imagine would want to host the final competition as well, and that it's not necessarily just a toss-up between somewhere in Germany and Nantes, which it's been for the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. Like, you can imagine it being even in somewhere like Płock, as a nice arena there. Lots of teams that maybe somewhere in Denmark as well, Montpellier in there as well, Sporting, and maybe even Bucharest. That'd be fun. But yeah, that's an interesting one. And then 51 teams have entered the third tier then, the old Challenge Cup, which is now called the HF European Cup. Something I'm kind of disappointed in. No teams whatsoever from our home region, not just like the UK and Ireland I'm talking about, because the UK have had teams pretty much every year for the last decade, but also no teams from the Faroe Islands, no teams from Belgium or Netherlands as well entering European competition this year, which I think is a bit of a pity. I would have thought this new competition would inspire some teams to take part, because it's got a, it's a nicer name than the Challenge Cup, which just, which really screams mediocrity and
screams wooden spoon.
Yeah, wooden spoon, exactly. Whereas this has a new brand of its own, and there are some decent teams in there, but yeah, for whatever reason, whether it be financial or health-wise, it has really left out a big chunk of Europe, which this competition, I think, is supposed to be aimed for. So you see it in other parts of Europe, like you've got a Bulgarian team in there, Cypriot teams in there, three Finnish teams, including Cox, which is a big drop down for them. Teams from Italy, Moldova, stuff like that, which isn't too far away from the Belgian, the Dutch, and even like the British teams. So yeah, a bit of a pity, I find, that they're not in it. And hopefully there'll be something done to entice them to come into it at some point, maybe like regional seeding or something like that in the future, like it was done in the, I think it's still done in football, right? With the first rounds of the, like the qualification, they have it, certain parts of Europe, teams will face each other. So you don't end up with a team from Iceland going to Israel for the first round, which could happen in handball in recent years. So
I think right now for those level teams, it's always been a financial burden to actually make it to a competition like that. You know, you need the sponsorship, you need the kind of crowdfunding for a team to be able to participate in there. And without a league finishing properly, without any sort of larger commitment from the players or from the overall organization, it's difficult to plan such an ambitious event for these lower teams. So I'm not surprised, but I don't think it's a longer term impact as long as everything's all right in the future.
Yeah, as you said, hopefully it's just a short term thing and next year teams will be enticed to play again. So before we move on to our chat with Bjorn Patson and we talk about our favorite Olympic memories, I'm going to use this opportunity to shamelessly plug another podcast I'm going to be involved in, which launches today. So the same day this podcast comes out, called Olympipod, which, as you would imagine, is a podcast all about the Olympics.
Who's Limpy?
I'm really surprised the name didn't get taken somehow. I think Olympipod is just such a genius name. So we'll see whether the Olympic Committee or the US Olympic Committee sue us after a couple of weeks. But that's the only fear, that there's a reason why it's not being used. But it's going to be a podcast released every 2 weeks, going through each and every of the modern Olympics and taking a bit of a lighthearted and fact-based view on it, trying to find some of the more bizarre stories of the Olympics. And we're beginning right from the start in 1896. And I can tell you now, the early Olympics are not short of bizarre stories. It's difficult to come by, but those that come out are very good and have even managed to include a handball story into the very first Olympipod based in 1896. Can you guess the connection, Alex?
I'm thinking something to do with the early field handball.
Even earlier than that.
Even earlier.
Mm.
So we're talking a version of handball that happened in the first Olympics.
Not quite. Not that early. Somewhere in between. So it was the very beginning of handball. And the man who most of the world accept as the founder of handball, Holger Nielsen, the Danish man who came up with an early set of the rules. Germans won't thank me for that, because as we know, the Germans like to claim that they created handball. So everyone else believe and accept it was Holger Nielsen. He competed in the very first Olympics and he finished third place in the saber event of fencing, and he got second and third place in shooting events as well. He was a bit of a multi-talented athlete, was Holger Nielsen. Only one of two Danes to compete in the Athens Olympics in 1896.
That sounds like a way of making him less dangerous. They took away his saber and his gun and gave him a ball.
Exactly.
Find something to do with that, Holger.
Believe it or not, he also came up with a version of CPR, which was accepted until like the late 50s. So like a resuscitation method, which was called the Nielsen method, which was accepted until the late 50s. So I learned an awful lot about Holger Nielsen. And if you want more facts like that, almost exclusively not about handball at this stage in the early podcasts, But more on Holger and the rest of the Olympics on Olympipod. So, moving on.
Let's focus on the handball side of the Olympics then.
And our interview with Trine Nielsen, former Danish international handball player, current TV expert as well in Denmark. She's going to speak to us about the 2004 Olympics in Athens and a match which the Olympic Channel describes as the most epic final in Olympic handball history, when Denmark took on South Korea, drew after 60 minutes, drew after two sets of extra times, and went to penalties. We should have been starting the Olympics this week, so we're looking back instead over some of the best handball moments. And a lot of people in the build-up had mentioned 2004. And I think even when you look it up on YouTube, the full game, the Olympic Channel call it the greatest ever final. So we thought it'd be great to talk to you about that that Olympics in general and the final. And I'll start by asking you, because you were just 23 years old at the time, coming towards the end of this amazing time for Danish women's handball. How involved were you in the team at the time? Where did you stand in the squad in the build-up?
I was not a big part of it, but I've been a part of the team since 2001. I also played the European Championship in 2002 in Denmark, where we took the gold medal. So a big part of the team, but not one of the leading roles. And also because in 2003, I tore my cross ligament in the knee. So I've been out of the team and actually struggling to get fit to play the Olympics. So that was a big goal for me, to make it to the Olympics. I think there were 14 players on the team, and I think I might have been picked as number 12, 13, 14, but it doesn't matter to me because I got in the squad.
Yeah, so that the mixture of you being young and then the knee injury as well. So I think you only started playing again at the beginning of the previous season, so like September. So how did you feel during that season in the build-up? Like, did you feel you had gone back to 100%, and were you confident that you were going to get into the national team again?
No, not at all. I tore my cross ligament, I think, a little over a year before the Olympics. And I actually remember, because it was a semifinal in the Champions League where it happened. And my only thought was, I have to get ready for the Olympics. And it was my first thought, actually, when I was in the dressing room after the match and crying, and everything was just tough. And I was sure that my ligament was torn, so no doubt about the long journey for recovery was just starting. But the Olympic was a big goal for me. So I fought and I trained very hard and I got back way too fast. Actually, I started training with the ball only 4 months after the surgery, and I played my first game 6 months after the surgery. And today, maybe that was a mistake, because now I'm going on 11 knee surgeries.
Oh,
two in one knee and nine in the other one. But fortunately, now I'm too old to play handball, so no more knee surgery for me.
Yeah.
I made it to the Olympics, so actually, in my book, it was worth it. But I never made it the same level. When I got the injury, I was playing very well. I played in EK Sporting, and we played the Champions League, and it was going very good. I was definitely on a peaking level, as always when you get a knee surgery. You are always on the top normally. And I never made it back, not even up to the Olympics and not even afterwards. Unfortunately, my career peaked when I was 23.
Yeah, but it sounds from what you're saying that the Olympics was so, so important for you. If that was the first thing going through your mind after this surgery, and I guess the fact also that Danish women's team were two-time reigning champions, like the Olympics was your jam, really. Personally, for you growing up as well, I guess, was the Olympics like the main goal for you?
Yeah, it was. I still remember at the age of 15, sitting actually on a course of being a trainer, being a coach. I was sitting and watching the Olympics from Atlanta, where Denmark played, and Anja Andersen missed a penalty shot. And I was thinking, at the age of 15, I want to try and do that. I want to be the one to do the penalty shot at the Olympics. Now I'm just glad I made it to the Olympics and didn't have to shoot the penalty shot. But I do remember at the age of 15, and also the Olympics in 2000, I just made it to EK Sporting, and some of my teammates were playing the Olympic final. And I, of course, watched it, and handball has been a big part of my my life. Every day I was in the training hall, and every weekend I spent with my family. My brother is also very involved in handball, so, and also my parents. So it's been a big part of my life. So I looked at what we in Danish call the jernhård ladies, the tough ladies. And I looked up to them all my childhood. So it was a big deal for me. And also the Olympics was the biggest thing you could ever imagine.
Do you remember where you were when you found out that you were in the 14 player squad?
Yeah.
Were you told before it was public, or did you have to wait for the public announcement?
No, we were told. And actually, I live in the town now where I was told that I was going to the Olympics in Svendborg. We were training here, the whole squad. I think we were 20 people. And I remember we were at the hotel and knew that everybody were told who were going to the Olympics. And the hallway of the hotel was dead quiet, because we knew that we were picked out and going in to Jan Pytlick and Kim Jensen and told, you're in or you're out. And then some people were overly ecstatic and some were very sad. So it was the strangest and hardest feeling, because when you were told that you were in, you were thrilled and glad and ecstatic, but also you were sad because some of your teammates didn't make it. Actually, first, when those people not going to the Olympics were told, you can go home if you want to. You can stay if you want to, but you can also go home because we know that you're disappointed. When they left, it was possible for the others to be glad. I do remember, and sometimes when I cross the street where the hotel is, I look up and I think about that particular day where we were told if you're in or out.
I got the mixture of emotions. That's heavy. And how long before the actual Olympics was that? So you were in a training camp before, not too long, I guess.
No, it was in the summertime. I don't remember. Approximately, it's a long time. It's 16 years ago. Yeah. So, but I think it was maybe 4 weeks before, but I'm not sure. But it was in the summertime, and the Olympics was in August.
When you were getting to Greece then and Athens, and that for itself, that Games was, I guess, incredibly important for the country, because for the first time in 108 years, they were getting back the Olympics where it had come from originally. So a big deal in the country itself and a big deal for Denmark. I guess there must have been a huge, huge amount of expectation on you as European champions, two-time Olympic champions. Did you feel anything like that?
Not to me. I was 23, so to me it was just a big thing to get to the Olympics. And at 23, you're kind of immortal. So it was also like, okay, it's the Olympics, but yeah, there'll be Olympics in 4 years again, so no problem. Now I sit back and think, oh my God, I should have enjoyed it more. But I didn't feel I don't think we felt the pressure. Just because Denmark already won it twice. And also the fact that you're going to the Olympics is such a big thing. The handball doesn't fill your mind as much in the beginning, because there are so many things to see when you go there. Just going into the Olympic city is a big thing. Everywhere you look, there are huge sports stars around you, and you're just a tiny person in that perspective. So all of the Olympics is an experience itself. And then, of course, the involvement of the handball tournament was big, because we ended up getting the gold. But I think the Olympics would have been a big experience no matter what.
From the early games, is there anything, any particular games that come to your mind, or any moments that made you feel, okay, I'm actually at the Olympics here?
I don't know about the games, because I think when you play, you're just in it. Then it's just a handball match. I think the Olympics for me was the experience of being a handball player. First of all, handball, half of the participant doesn't know what handball is. But also, we are down there with a lot of Danish people, athletes. So it's like one big family. And that was a big experience for me, because a normal tournament, you're just yourself. You're just the team against all other countries. Here it's all other sports also. And we were like, we played games every third day. So we had a lot of free time. And we trained, but honestly, if you compare it to some of the other sports, handball players doesn't train that much. So, of course, we trained handball and we also ran and all that. But some of the guys doing the other sports trained all the time. And they had to do one competition. Then they were out. Then they were finished. And they finished 3 days after we arrived. So it was... Yeah. It was a strange experience, but also a good experience to be able to follow the other Danish athletes and cheer them on. So the handball tournament was like a side part of all of the experience.
Handball aside then, what was your favorite part?
It was great to be able to see the other athletes doing their competition. But one of the most fun thing actually was going to this great dining area where you can sit for an entire day and just look at people, because at the Olympics, and that's the amazing part of the Olympics, you go in handball, when we look at each other, we look almost alike. Of course, some are small, some are big, but almost. And you go to the Olympics and you see the biggest difference. All people are athletes, but you see a small Chinese gymnast girl or a big American basketball player or a weightlifter, and all are athletes, but on their different areas. And that was amazing, just sitting there. And also the fact that you can sit in the dining area and you could go and you can choose, today I want some Italian, or I want to go have a burger from McDonald's, or I want to eat cereal all day long. You could do whatever you want. And there were a room for 5,000 people at the dining area, and it was just... Every day was just like you saw something new. And that's also funny. you saw a lot of big stars. I'm very bad at facial recognition, so I didn't know who was who, but a lot of my teammates ran around with cameras and taking pictures, and it was just an amazing experience.
That's so cool. I want to focus a bit on Korea. You had faced them in the group phase at the beginning of the tournament and drew with them. They're a very different style team. They had a lot of Olympic history as well. Do you remember what the approach from Jan was to facing Korea and the build up to the final, and how you as players looked at them? Because I guess when you're facing Korea, you have to be in a different mindset, particularly when you're playing in defense.
Yeah, and that was the main part. The part where we had to realize that, yes, you are going to look like an idiot at some point, because they are so amazing and so fast in their attack and in their footwork. So you're going to look like an idiot, but you have to forget it and move on. And I think also because we were not used to playing that style. So you can't train it. You can look at all the video you want and you can try to imagine how it will be, but you can't train it, because I cannot go in and be one of the players, because I'm not nearly as fast and I'm not nearly as good as they are. So we play in such a different way. So you can only progress doing the match. I actually think it was a good thing for us that we met them early in the tournament also.
Yeah, so no surprises there. You told me when we were messaging earlier in the week that you don't remember too much about the game itself. What do you remember?
I remember the feelings. I remember everything about the feeling, the nervousness. Not because it was a problem, but you know, when you sit in the bench, you feel way more than you do on the field. And I sat on the bench, and I'm grateful that I got in and played a little and even got to score a goal and give something for my teammates. But in fact, I sat a lot on the bench, and that was nerve-wracking, sitting out there and not being able to do anything but to cheer the girls on. And of course, I remember the penalties. I remember when we had to choose the players to shoot the penalties, Henry and Mikkelsen, who actually ended up making the final score, were selected as number 5. And she turned all white in the head, because she knew that number 5 normally were the one to do the best thing. But she turned all pale. And we were like, I don't think it's her who's going to be number 5. And then they moved her up for number 4. And she ended up being the big hero. So,
amazing.
Yeah, yeah. So that was perfect. And then, of course, I remember the feeling when she scored. And also the fact that Kai Mortensen came in and did a great job in the final, because actually it was the second keeper, Rikke Schmidt, who played the best tournament, actually. But Kai Mortensen was amazing in the goal in the final. So then I just remember the party and the feeling of being somewhere else looking down on myself being so happy.
The scenes at the end were great. Yeah. I want to go back to what you said about being on the bench and coming on first, because I remember watching back on it and I checked up recently again just to see when you came in. In both halves, it was about the 20-minute mark. So you had a fair bit of time to wait, but in the first half in particular, Mette Vestergaard, she missed a few shots in a row. So you must have known, it's like, okay, now I've got to get myself ready to come in. Do you remember what, I guess the fear is one thing, but were you just happy that you were going to finally get your hands on the ball?
First of all, I was happy, but I also had the fear because even though I was young and even though I thought that it just put me in, I can do everything, something in the back of my head knew that I wasn't at the level I was before my knee injury. So I knew that the difference between me and Mette Vestergaard was big. And I was a substitute for her and for Josephine Touré on the wing. But I also knew that I could do something. I knew going to the Olympics that I wasn't going to play a lot of minutes. But I knew that I had to be good when I played. And actually, I struggled a bit with, I don't think I was nervous, but I struggled a little bit with my own expectation. I wanted to be better and I wasn't able to. So I'm glad I played the minutes and I'm glad it, actually, I have to say, I haven't seen the match since we played it.
No.
So maybe I like to remember that I didn't do so bad.
No, I don't think you. Well, just before you scored your goal, you scored another goal which was not counted for steps. And that was very close, I think, between the zero step and the 1-2. So I think that was, you know, if the referees weren't paying so much attention, you might have gotten away with that. So on the penalties, if you were asked, would you have taken one? Would you have liked to take a penalty? Because usually left-handers are big penalty takers, but none in this team.
No. I was when I was a young player, but not anymore. I don't know why. And I think I used the most of my career afterwards to tell my trainer, my coaches, that I had to do the penalties. But only in the last 2 years I did. But I would like to say that I just would have said yes. But I think I was a little afraid. It wasn't a theme that I was going to play to shoot the penalty because I haven't shot a penalty for many years at that time. So it wasn't a theme. But who wouldn't have liked to be Henriette Mikkelsen at that point and doing the final score? That would have been great. But she deserved it. So.
And it's so funny, like after, you know, so many ups and downs in that game, and it was so tight throughout that the penalties were almost too easy. Everything went so perfectly well in the end. You know, you scored 4 out of 4, two saves as well from the Koreans, and it was just, it was almost too straightforward. But do you remember you mentioned the celebrations there. What did you get up to after the game?
Yeah, first of all, it was just a great big of happiness. The fun part is the whole tournament we played in the nighttime. But the final were played in the morning because it was on the final day, so the closing ceremony were at night. And half of the team went to the closing ceremony. All of the players who hadn't been to the Olympics before wanted to see what it was about. And the girls who already tried it said, it's not that great. We'll stay at home. And then we just we went to the closing ceremony, and it wasn't that great, but it was something that I wouldn't miss. And then we came home to the Olympic town and we just had a great party. And everybody, all the athletes were finished at that time. So everybody were able to just let loose. And when you've been so serious for so long and haven't touched a sniff of alcohol, it went a little crazy. I remember that the next morning, our coach, Jan Pytlick, went down to our chef de mission and said, you don't need cleaning. You need something to rebuild the apartment. Yeah, so no cleaning, just rebuild the apartment. Because we had the party at our apartment in the Olympic town. And the day after, we found a camera and nobody knew any of the people on the camera. And suddenly some people from another country came and said, oh, that's my camera. And we were like, okay, were you here last night?
Amazing.
It was a great finish, but it was a fun thing also in the Olympics because now we won this gold medal and we wore it in the city, in the Olympic town. And a lot of people stopped us and said, ah, congratulations. It's amazing. It's beautiful. And which sports do you play? And we were like, yeah, we play handball. And they were like, okay, great. Congratulations. They didn't know what it was. And to us, handball is the biggest thing.
That's an awesome story. It's so crazy to think that you know, since 2004, that Denmark has only qualified for one Olympic since then. It's been a real kind of fall from grace, I suppose you could say. Was it just the case that this golden generation naturally was coming to an end, or what happened, do you think?
It's a difficult question. My generation were lucky because we saw Anja Andersen and all the big stars, Camilla Andersen, and saw it, and we had no expectation, but we grew up looking at them. When I was a child, you played on the street or you went to football or handball or anything, and then that's what you did. Today, you have so many options. And I think that's one of the reasons why. Also because when I went to school, I wanted to play handball. I graduated, but all my thoughts were on handball. School was a small thing. Today, the young people have to be good in school, in handball, on social media, on everything. And I think that makes it difficult for them. And I think that's part of the history of why, maybe in Denmark, maybe we got a little spoiled because we knew it was great. Denmark was good, no competition. But suddenly the other countries became way better. And right now, I think Denmark is on the verge of doing something good again and being a part of the very best. Because right now they are in the sub. In a very good tournament, they can go all the way. But right now it is from place 6 to 10, maybe. And qualification for the Olympics is so hard because you have to do one bad match and then there's no chance. Yeah. And that's a problem for Denmark right now. But I'm crossing my fingers because I truly believe that Denmark belongs there. When I look at the players, I think you can do something great with them. But it takes time and it takes also an understanding of how hard you must work, and also out in the clubs, how much we can't take things for granted anymore.
And so you think your brother's in a good position?
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to put a lot of pressure on him, but I said it before. I said it when Klaus Brun was the coach. Also, I think the potential is there, and I think the opportunities are there. But I also know that for now, these girls haven't won any medals since 2013. That's also a problem because your confidence, it just goes low. And right now, every time they doesn't win, everybody's like, oh, they're bad and they don't know how to play. And even though you as a player say, I don't want to listen to it, you hear it and you read it. And especially the social media, people can sit behind the screen and just tear people apart. And that's difficult for a young player to understand and to resist not reading these things because you want to read it when it's good, but it's difficult not reading when it's bad. So it hurts their confidence. So I hope my big brother can do something with their confidence because I think that these girls, if they just grow on that part, and also if the population in Denmark gives them a little credit, then they can grow. And I hope that this our next tournament in Denmark will help do that. And then they hopefully soon can be part of the Olympics again.
We've seen over the years, as you said, the team seems to be able to beat anyone on a good day. And then at the same time, when it comes to a big occasion, not show up. And the attention as well in Denmark, you say from the public as well, but there's no other nation in women's handball that has so much media attention as well. So TV networks and written media as well. It's incredible. So you said the confidence is a big part there for Jesper to integrate into the team. Do you think that is one of his strengths? Because, well, we've seen how many big strengths he has with Esbjerg in the last couple of years. What do you think he'll bring to the team?
Well, you can't ask a little sister if her big brother gives confidence because all of my childhood he's been bullying me. But yeah, I think we've seen it in Esbjerg. I think he's good around the girls. I think he's good at boosting his team. So I hope he can do that. But this is also a big part for the girls to lift, to find out if they can lift each other because they have to. They have to help each other because right now, also in Denmark, the fact is when in the 90s when the women's handball in Denmark was big, the men's handball wasn't big. And now when men's handball are very big in Denmark and very popular, it's easier to tell everybody that women's handball is not that good. Only men is good. We don't want to watch the women. We just want to watch the men. But I'm like, why can't you watch both of them? Why can't you celebrate both of them? If the women had missed a championship like the men did last time, they would have been murdered in the press and also in the population in another way than the men did. We still, in Denmark, we think, hey, it was one time for the men. They'll be back. Nobody thinks that about the women. But I do. And I do truly hope that they will get back on track. And I think this next tournament in Denmark can help them because the audience is a big part of if we get an audience in Denmark. Yeah. That's also a big hope because I think that will be a big part of the team to get back on track.
Well, that's brilliant. And a great insight as well there, Trine. Thanks so much for your time.
Awesome. You're welcome.
And hopefully see you at some point in December. Will you be working in the TV team at all?
No. Maybe. I don't know yet. I won't be working in anything about Denmark, but maybe there'll be a smaller studio following Norway or one of the other teams.
Yeah.
And I'm crossing my finger that TV2 will give me a part of that because my big brother pushed me away from the other part of it. But that's the way it is.
It's the way it is. Hopefully see you in Norway then.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Thanks so much, Trine.
Bye.
Thank you so much to Trina for that very interesting and quite fun chat about the 2004 Olympics and her experience. We'll have another podcast all about Olympic memories next time. And we want to hear from you. What are your favorite Olympic handball moments? Tell us all about it. Get in touch with us on Instagram or Twitter at Handball Hour or send us a mail. handballhour@gmail.com, and we'll read out some of your favorites in our next episode. But for now, that's it from another Uninformed Handball Hour. Goodbye.